I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey there, I'm Rosemary Barton.
And I'm Alameen Abdul Mahmoud.
And this is Party Lines.
And Rosie, for a lot of people across this country, particularly people my age and younger, buying a home is getting further and further out of reach by the day. So today, we gotta talk about it. We gotta talk about how the Canadian economy is just strapped to the real estate IV bag and what the federal leaders could do to make a change for the better.
I know you have a lot to say about that. Look forward to it. I also want to talk a bit about this third wave of COVID, variants of concern driving up case counts in many provinces in this country. And while some experts have described it as a race between variants and the vaccine, is it really even a race at this point? Are we falling too far behind on public health measures to keep cases down while, you know, rushing to try and get shots into arms?
So much to get to, so let's do it.
Okay.
All right, Rosie, I want to talk about this, and I have a lot of feelings, and Okay, let me start with
this. You've got a lot of feelings.
I do. I really do. I really do. And the feelings come from this reality that, you know, in these deep, dark hours of the pandemic, like, I'm sitting around and I have one refuge, and that refuge is Zillow, the app where I can just scroll through houses that are available in my neighborhood, or, you know, maybe just outside the city, just to browse around houses that I like to be like, oh, I would set this up differently and fantasize about them and think about them. And then close the app and cry into my pillow, because housing prices in the city where I live, but also just across the country, are getting utterly unhinged. And there's nothing that I can do about it. All I can do is look. And I don't enjoy it. I don't enjoy that part of the ritual. Like, I think back to last year, at the start of the pandemic, we heard a lot of economic forecasters who were like, oh, wow, housing prices might fall. Like, they've been rising for so long, and they might finally start to make their way down. Well, I don't want to spoil anything, but they didn't. Across the country, most major cities recorded double-digit increases in the prices of housing. In Nova Scotia, prices of homes in January and February went up more than 30% what it was compared to 2020. We entered a recession in the last year. The economy contracted, and housing prices just kept going up. And all these real estate agents that I followed years ago on Instagram, just to, like, keep the dream alive, they're all just posting hashtags like, the market is hot. And I'm sure it's really fun for them, but it is not fun for me. And I don't think I'm the only person here, because there are a lot of other young millennials for whom, you know, the idea of homeownership is just like, it's felt like this out of reach dream, but now it's just in the stratosphere. And we make jokes about it. Like, I make a lot of jokes about it, but, like, it genuinely, from time to time, fills me with anguish. And again, to reiterate, not the only person. The research shows that it would take a young person 24 years to save for a down payment to be able to afford a house in some of these big cities. And we gotta talk about this. We gotta talk about what the government's going to do about it, if they're going to do anything. If that's just like, oh, this is how we live now, and the government's comfortable with that, there's just too much to react to.
Yeah, you got a lot of feelings. You got a lot. And I'm going to say things that are going to give you more feelings.
Good.
First, let me also, like, highlight the fact that this is not just in cities where you might expect it to happen, like where you are in Toronto or in Vancouver, which have long been sort of viewed as some of the least affordable cities in the world to purchase real estate and to live in. But it's also in places like Halifax. It's also where I am in Ottawa. It's in places like Moncton. And some of that is about people making decisions conversations during a pandemic about their lifestyle and realizing that maybe remote work can happen forever and they don't need to be in these urban centers. Sometimes it's about people wanting more space. It is not actually, downtown Toronto where everyone's trying to snap up houses and condos. It's a lot of people moving out to the greater Toronto area too. So there's all sorts of unusual sort of patterns of behavior going on because there's a pandemic feeding into the real estate market. But the thing that I really want to tell you, for people that don't know, I'm slightly older than you, slightly older, like maybe 12 years older than you. Yeah. And I am not, I'm not going to get in deep in my finances here, but I'm not like a wizard with money. I do not have, personal wealth from my family. I'm not great at investing money. But about, let's see, I'm going to say 20 years ago, maybe less than 20 years ago, I bought my first condo in Quebec City. I can't remember the price, but I remember the down payment because I initially wasn't sure I could afford it. Mm-hmm. And the down payment was $5,000.
Oh.
$5,000 for a one bedroom condo, a beautiful stone wall in the lower town, La Basseville in Quebec City. And I sold that condo, obviously, when I moved to Ottawa. I purchased and sold again. I purchased again, which leads me to the third place that I've now owned. And all of that, obviously, you accumulate equity over time. And I'm telling you this, well, not to make you want to go just to give up.
No, it's too late. You've already done it.
I know. But to demonstrate that part of this is generational. It is total luck. And I know our producer, Nick, feels the same way. He's the same age as I am. It's not because I'm some guru of the real estate market. It's because I got in at a time where it was possible to get in and your equity does go up and you manage to make money after you put new tile in a bathroom and suddenly you can afford a house that you didn't think you could afford. So I guess what I'm saying is barring putting you in a time machine and putting you back to where I was so you could actually get a foothold in the real estate market. Mm-hmm. What else could policymakers, government, the Bank of Canada do to try and help you get in there? And the answer is, I'm not sure that they're even going to do it. The governor of the Bank of Canada, Tiff Macklin, says it is not the time right now to tighten up any rules around home ownership. He does admit that there are early signs of what he calls excess exuberance. But because we're in the midst of a pandemic, because the economy is still so unstable, because there's no real growth yet, because there's so many people out of work, it is not the time to start messing around in the housing market and real estate. So is that the end of this conversation? I don't know.
Well, no, but I do think that that is a good point to jump off of, because there is this hesitation to do something that is meaningful.
Yes.
To interrupt the cycle. The federal minister responsible for the housing corporation, Ahmed Hassan, told Matt Galloway this week that he believes ownership is still within reach for many Canadians and in the majority parts of the country. And I think that is a very selective phrasing. Yeah, it is within reach for many Canadians, aka people who already have that equity, and in the majority parts of the country, as in, I don't know, in the empty plots of land in between large cities and the prairies, sure, that you could absolutely buy a home there. But that is not where most people are, and that is not where most people are trying to get into the market. And look, the government introduced a first-time home buyer's incentive. Yep. Basically, the government gives you this 0% loan to boost your down payment, but then they end up taking an equity on your home when you sell it later. But the uptake on that program has been pretty low. 9,500 people applied to the program in its first year. This program's been around for 2.5 years. So far, the government allocated $1.25 billion to the program. And by September 2020, they'd only spent $173 million of that. And we should say, this doesn't help exactly. This might help get you in on the action on the demand side. And I'm not an economist, but I did not skip the class where I learned that more demand is just going to push up the prices. There's lots of things that the government can do to curb that demand. We're seeing, New Zealand, who's dealing with a lot of similar stuff to Canada. One of the things that they introduced is said, okay, if you're going to buy a home that you live in, you can have a 20% down payment, which is, similar to what Canada has. Mm-hmm. But if it's going to be an investment property, actually that down payment is going to have to be 40%. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, if you're a speculator, if you're someone who just gets gets into the market and you're like, this is a safe place to park my money, you're thinking twice about whether you should spend 40% of the money on a certain product. And here's the part that I wish someone in government would say out loud, is that we won't cool the housing market because right now we can't, because it's the only sector that is growing in a pandemic and is growing so much while we're in the middle of this recession. And to kill its momentum would be a hard choice for the economy. C.D. Howe, which is a free market think tank, wrote a piece last week in the Financial Post saying, actually, the housing market might be propping up too much of Canada's economy right now. Like, we think of ourselves as this resource economy, and yes, we do extract and sell oil, but right now we're in the business of housing because there's so much wealth that is you know, like, in that particular sector. And that is worrisome. That is worrisome because that is a bubble and it could pop. That demand could go anytime. And those prices could fall. And, like, all these things are worrying, but to see the government not taking it seriously or not wanting to do anything about it has been continuously frustrating. And as I think forward to the federal budget that is going to come up in a couple of weeks, we've seen Chrystia Freeland talk about maybe the government is going to introduce some things that deal with this. But if the only solution that they have is to get young people in on the demand side and increase the prices higher, I just don't know if that's a solution.
Yeah, what you say about how much of the housing market makes up our gross domestic product is important. It's 10%. That's twice that of the United States. And the reason that that's important is what you said there. It leaves us exposed if this thing does collapse. That means that a lot of our broad-based economy is going to be in some trouble. If people suddenly can't afford the houses that they've purchased and all that starts to fall down because it's not a real thing, right? It's a lot of demand, up demand and enthusiasm for something that's not real, then you run the risk of a broader consequence to the economy. Here's, I think, the government's dilemma as they head up to this budget coming now fairly soon, is do they want to put something in place to make it easier for people like you to buy a house right now?
I beg of you. Please. I beg of you.
Or do they want things to settle a little bit more in the economy before they make those kinds of moves to help people? I think there's a difference between acknowledging that as a problem and acknowledging that the housing market is an issue and they're worried about the fragility of it. But we don't really know what the economy is going to look like over the next 6 months. You know, if they invest between $70 and $100 billion in stimulus, which is what they are projecting, what they have been talking about, what kind of change does that bring to the economy, you know, by the fall? And is there a possibility that some of this stuff starts to sort its way out itself? I don't know. But I think that that's the dilemma the government has. So, like, all of this to say, I hope your condo is, like fairly comfortable.
First of all, like a dagger to my heart. And second of all, I want to also talk about something that you addressed there, which is, you know, this idea of waiting till this market settles. Because in the Financial Post, we saw a BMO survey that said, you know, 40% of first-time home buyers are planning to hold off until the prices settle a little bit.
Yeah.
And millennials, my people, are the group most likely to wait. But the thing is, they're looking to pay an average of $433,000 for a new home. That is already well below the average price for a home. So, like, they're willing to wait and then pay a price that is way lower than the current average price. I just don't think, like, we would be facing down a correction that is so sharp in order for housing prices to come down that much. And we also keep hearing this point about interest rates being so low, because they are at a historic lows right now, that why so many people are jumping in the market. But here's the thing. If you'd like to buy a house right now, you have to qualify by passing the stress test.
Yeah.
And the stress test is you have to qualify at a much higher interest rate, just in case the interest rates do go up. The stress test rate is higher than even the 2008 crisis rate, according to Benjamin Tal over at CIBC. So it's not just, you know, this bigger trend of people investing because the interest rates are low. It's because there are a lot of people who already have money who are using the housing market as a way to park their money and to earn money. I mean, like, this is more reliable than the lottery, and I just have to sit on the sidelines and watch.
We could probably do the whole podcast about this, and you have a lot to say. Let me just end on this, though, and Amy, you can say something after if you want. But, like, the thing that worries me about this, beyond the potential damage to our economy, beyond you never getting more than two rooms, is there is an issue of equality and equity in society around this. This is not just about, you know, whether you can afford a house. It's about, does this mean that only certain people deserve to own a home? And I think that that's like a broader societal question that we need to grapple with, because the answer should be no. The answer that should be that everyone should have the ability to purchase a home, you know, that they can afford within certain parameters. But if we're getting to a point where only the richest or the people who got into the market a long time ago, like me, can afford a home, then I think we have a much broader philosophical conversation that we need to start having.
I'm Jonathan Goldstein, host of Wiretap. Each week you're invited to listen in on my telephone conversations, whether funny, sad, wistful, or even slightly strange. You never know just what you might hear on Wiretap.
I mean, I knew you had a show. I just didn't think that people actually listened to it.
Howard,
that's the breadth of your genius, Jonathan. It's not just that you're funny, but you can be cripplingly, poignantly depressing.
The Wiretap Archives, available on CBC Listen, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
You may have noticed, Elamine, that large parts of this country are now in a third wave. I think that's fair to say, of this pandemic. Cases are on the rise in Alberta, Saskatchewan, Ontario, Quebec. The number of active cases is up 50% since March. And this has started to put an enormous amount of pressure on our healthcare system, obviously our hospitals. In Ontario, the ICUs have gone way up, surpassed the previous highs during the pandemic. In BC, there are so many cases that they've now had to put in restrictions that they haven't had in place for many, many months. Restrictions on indoor dining, fitness groups. So they have put in place what we call a circuit breaker, where they shut everything down hard for 3 weeks in hopes of seeing a change of things in that time. We are in a really sort of bleak place in this pandemic. It's happening, of course, as we see more and more vaccine coming into the country this week, more than 3 million doses of vaccine supposed to arrive. And as those numbers start to get, well, supposedly more stable as we move forward. But we are at a space where, for some reason, even though we've been doing this now for more than a year, it seems difficult for politicians to put in place the public health restrictions that are clearly needed given the huge increase in numbers due to variants and other things.
Every day that I see the numbers, I'm filled with a little bit more dread, and I think, yeah, like, this state of affairs is going to last just a little bit longer, and it's a little bit more indefinite than it was before. And I don't think I'm alone in maybe attributing hope and optimism to all this news of the vaccines. You know, I think I laser focused, like a lot of other people did, on all the incoming shipments of vaccines. I was really up to date on all, you know, delays and like, oh, this shipment is delayed and it's going to be coming next week, etc. And I think couched in all of that was this dream that we are going to vaccinate our way out of this wave, vaccinate our way out of, you know, this wave arriving. We can get ahead of it. There will come a point where vaccines are the solution, but right now that is not the most immediate solution that we are facing. They will eventually get us out of this.
Yeah, and even Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister, said we have to stay strong for a number of more months. We're expecting 44 million doses of vaccine by Canada Day. We are going to get to a place where things can start to be more normal, be relaxed. But we're not in that place right now.
Maybe it was because we have been in lockdown for so long, particularly in Toronto where I live, where we've been in lockdown since literally November. But lots of other places have been in lockdown for a long time as well. And the dream was, I think, that once you start to see vaccines, then you can begin to let up on your restrictions. And we indeed started to do that. In lots of places in the country, places started to open up. I think a lot of people were surprised this week when we heard that Bonnie Henry in BC was going to tell British Columbians that actually they can't have indoor dining anymore, to which I said, you had indoor dining to begin with? I don't actually understand that, you know, I can't believe that that was your reality. In the US, as my good friend John Michael McGrath from TVO points out, they are way ahead of us on vaccines in terms of people already vaccinated, but also in terms of just like the supply that is available for vaccines. And they themselves are seeing an increase in cases, an increase in hospitalizations, which tells us that actually, even if we were to catch up to the amount of vaccines that the US has distributed, we would still be in this position, which is to say that this wave is already here and is already powerful, and we are reacting to it in a way where it seems like it's too late. We've heard Ontario politicians say that about 67%, two-thirds of new cases now are these variants of concern, which are more contagious, which raises the question, A, could we have done more to predict that this was going to happen? I think the answer is yes. And B, if we knew we were heading in this direction, why didn't we stop it earlier?
One of the key scientific advisors here in Ontario, Dr. Peter Uni, says that the pandemic is completely out of control in Ontario. And also says, and this is something that epidemiologists across the country are saying, stop thinking that the vaccine is the solution to this. It is not the solution right now. We do not have enough right now. We are vaccinating as quickly as we get the stuff, but we simply don't have enough. So the solution right now is to go back to the things that we've been doing for quite some time. And you do see in some parts of the country where there has been spread, where there's been variants of concern, like, for instance, Regina in Saskatchewan saw that start to pop up over the past couple of weeks. And this past Sunday locked it all down, including sending the kids home. They have to do virtual learning going forward. Some people in Saskatchewan say that might not have happened fast enough, given that they're now seeing variants of concern pop up in places like Moose Jaw. But we are at a place where other provinces like Quebec, which has seen an increase in cases in some parts of the province, and like this province, Ontario, which is now averaging, you know, 2,300, 2,400 cases a day, is going to have to start making some very quick and serious decisions as these variants start to spread even faster. Dr. Tam, just on Tuesday, I believe, said that there's more than 9,000 cases related to variants, principally that B117 variant that originated in the United Kingdom. Doug Ford, the Premier of Ontario, as we're recording this, is set to make an announcement on what he's going to do on Thursday. But we are in a place where, and I think this is the frustrating part as just a regular human, is where we didn't really have to be. We really didn't have to be in this place. And yet here we are.
One of the things that we're hearing a lot about is how many young people are getting the virus in this particular wave, particularly between 20 to 39-year-olds. And I think it needs to be said out loud that I don't know a lot of 20 to 39-year-olds who are just like partying in the street, who are just like, I don't know, gathering in their homes. Anecdotally, certainly, but most of the people that I know are just not gathering indoors. What has happened is we've seen a gradual reopening in a bunch of industries where those people work, where they are the frontline workers, restaurant business, for example. This has been a reality for them. And like, could these things be related? Of course they could. And we have to ask ourselves, are we doing everything that we can to protect the people who are in those front lines? One thing that the government of Ontario, for example, has been facing repeated calls for is paid sick leave. At a certain point, it becomes absurd that they haven't responded to these calls, because they just keep saying, okay, we're going to like look into it. And they've been looking into it for maybe, you know, 8 months at this point. So I think we just have to keep driving the point home that there have been many options available to many governments across the country, and they just haven't taken them all. And now we're facing down this wave. And And the numbers that we are seeing and the consequences we are seeing are in part the direct result of some of the choices those governments made.
That is, well, it's the sound of me and my pandemic puppy living it up on the weekends, because that's the only stranger I've brought into my home over the past year.
That sounds joyous. I love that.
Yeah, she's great. It's also the sound of Last Call, though. Last week, you might remember, we talked about the RCMP watchdog report that found the force racially discriminated against the family of Colton Bushy as they handled the shooting death of that young First Nations man in Saskatchewan back in 2016. And we asked you, do you feel the RCMP is able to tackle the problem of systemic racism within its own ranks?
Yeah, several people highlighted the original roots of the RCMP as an issue. One person wrote, the RCMP was created to intimidate police and endanger Indigenous communities, and that taking steps like anti-bias training served to perpetuate an institution that is inherently racist. We should get rid of it. Another person pointed out how this could be the time to create a modern community service in its place. And another suggested a more immediate solution could be hiring more First Nations officers.
So this week we want to know, how the heck are these high real estate prices affecting you in many parts of the country? And specifically, how long would it take you anyway to save for a down payment for a house? Elamine, you can answer one day as well. You can tweet us. I'm at Rosie Barton.
And I'm at Elamine88. Please tweet us. I'd like the answers to this. And throw in the hashtag Party Lines. Let us know what you think.
And that is it for Party Lines this week from CBC News and CBC Podcasts. I'm Rosemary Barton, Chief Political Correspondent for CBC News.
And I'm Elamine Abdul Mahmoud. I'm going to rent for the rest of my life. I am culture writer for BuzzFeed News.
Oh, see you back here next week.
You bet.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.